Bonjour et bienvenue à la balado-diffusion du colloque « Éthique des médias, de l'information au marché » tenu à Montréal en avril 2009. Welcome to the audio podcast of the Media Ethics from Information to Markets Conference that took place in Montreal in April 2009.
So thank you very much to have returned from the short break. The next panelist will be Dominique Martin. He's currently a student, PhD student, both at the University of Montreal and the Université Catholique de Louvain in Belgium. He's working under the supervision of Daniel Weinstock and Axel Gossery. I cannot resist the temptation. What is the title of the thesis?
The title is Moral Motivation and Obligation of Market of a Corporation in Markets, but I'm not sure if I'm going to put in markets in the title or not. It's a really boring title. I hope that I will come out with something more interesting till the end of my PhD.
So just to finish the short bio, he worked for the CREUM et la chaire en éthique des affaires de l'Université de Montréal, and he published a few papers in International Journal of Technology and Knowledge and Society.
All right, thank you very much. So I will be, so the title of my presentation in English could be translated in something like the difficult equilibrium of LT competition. So I've decided to make my presentation in English finally, because after being performing some simultaneous translation yesterday for numerous times, I understand all the challenges of that exercise, both from the person that translate and the person that have to follow what the other person is translating. But the PowerPoint will be in French, so in this way I hope to achieve linguistic neutrality the same way I'm trying to discuss about healthy competition equilibrium in this in this presentation. So what I'm going to try to do really briefly today is try to apply a framework I developed in my PhD that I call adversarial ethics. It's, the expression does not come from me, but and I will try to see how it applies to mediatic institution. I will say more about this in a short time. So when we look at the mediatic institution, we see that it's a context that is marked by really multiple forms of rivalry. So for a start, there is a rivalry between mediatic institutions, one newspaper compared to the other, and Elisa Maria have provided a pretty good example of that. But there's also rivalry between journalism, so journalists from one newspaper to the other, for instance, but also maybe journalists among the same mediatic institution. And most of the time, there's also rivalry between mediatic institution and other social institutions. For instance, executive, the political executive power institution, or the legal system also. So some people will say that there's a lot of advantage to this. So maybe we can make a short sport analogy here, but we could say that it helps journalists, you know, to give the best out of themselves, the same way sport competition helps athletes to give good performances. We could also say that it increases the productivity of media, or we could also say that it helps to diversify the points of view that we will see. Of course, all these arguments are rather, we can make counter-argument for all these arguments also, of course. But on the other side, there's also a lot of inconvenience. And I think the most important one is that it often places the journalists in a really conflicting position, because they are often facing really different moral obligation, and it's hard for them to decide what type of obligation should be prioritized over other ones. And so, and when you look at the literature and media ethics case studies, for example, you see that most of many of the most popular cases that are studied in media ethics are cases that that are characterized by an important rivalry. For instance, conflict of interest, protection of sources, and in the second case, it would be a rivalry between mediatic institution and legal institution, for instance. Protection of privacy, journalist objectivity. So I took these cases in a book written by someone named Christians. Yes, Media Ethics, Cases and Moral Reasoning. It's quite a popular book in media ethics. They're up to the 8th edition, I think. So considering all this, I think there are three important questions we could ask. So the first question is that could this be different? Could this rivalry characteristic of a mediatic institution be different? First question. Second question, is it a good thing? So we had a roundtable yesterday night, and like Pierre-Yves was pointing out, most of the people started by saying, yes, it's a good thing, and then spent an hour showing why it was not the case. And thirdly, what's the best way to make out the best of this context of rivalry? So the good news is that there's a field or a branch of moral philosophy that is interests into the type of moral obligation that stem from context marked by a strong rivalry, and it's called, well, I call it adversarial ethics. I think Mr. Applebaum called it this way too. There could be other name, I guess. So that's the good news, but the bad news is that it's a branch of moral philosophy that is really strongly criticized. So what I'm going to try to do is try to apply this framework of adversarial ethics to media ethics and see what we can come out of with this. Okay, so just briefly my presentation plan. So I've dealt with the introduction and the problematic already. So now we'll say more about adversarial institution, and in a third time I will try to say how can we apply adversarial institution to mediatic institution. Sorry, I've said that many times already. And so maybe it's important to be clear about the goal of what I'm going to say. So it's really to provide some philosophical substance, or well, maybe not substance, but question, juice, philosophical juice, thank you, to think about good public policies that should apply to media in general. Okay. So what is adversarial ethics exactly? Well, there's at least two definitions. So the first one, we could say it's a branch of, well, either moral philosophy, ethics, political philosophy, that is interested in moral obligation that stem from contexts where there is a strong rivalry or where agents are adversaries. So that's the first definition. There's a lot of example of these contexts. For instance, courts and tribunal, sportive competition, electoral politics, and even economic markets, for example. And so the particularities of this context is that we seem to have different moral expectations from agents when they are acting in this type of context. So if we take a recent example in the news, for instance, because I've been hearing about this for many days now, so there is, I think, a trial that's going to start between Woody Allen and Dove Charney, that is the PDG of American Apparel, because I think Mr. Charney have used the image of Woody Allen in some of the American Apparel really provocative publicity, and apparently Woody Allen didn't like it, and so I think the Charney party will try to prove that. So Mr. Allen didn't like it because he said that it was damaging his reputation, and I think that American Apparel will try to prove that Woody Allen didn't add any reputation to damage, so it was not wrong to using his image to sell more T-shirts. So that's what, but that's not really interesting. The case, the particular case, is not really important here, but it's just to say that whatever happened next, they're both going to take lawyers, and they're both going to go in court, and they're both going to defend their position. And the type of obligation that is expected from the lawyers, in this case, is really different than the type of obligation that would be expected from other agents in other situations. For instance, I guess both expect the lawyer will do as much as they can to promote both parties' interest. Okay, so that's the first definition. So a branch of moral philosophy interested in obligation that's deemed from rivalry context. But we have to be careful also because a lot of time adversarial ethics is also used to refer to arguments in favor of adversarial institution. And the reason in favor of context of rivalry. And the reason for it is that when you say that you're going to defend an adversarial ethics, most of the time you implicitly mean that you're going to defend the fact that there should be more adversarial institution. And so, unfortunately, I tend to use the expression the both ways, so I just prefer to be clear. So, adversarial ethics have often been presented as a form of professional ethics because it's interested into the professional obligations of agents when they are into specific adversarial institution. For instance, it's interested into the obligation of a lawyer in court, for instance, or athletes. But I think it goes out of the realm of professional ethics quite rapidly because it's also interested in all the practices of agents when they are acting within adversarial institution. So making this precision means that, in fact, more than being simply a professional ethics theory, it's much more a theory of institutional design. When I say this, I mean, so I use the expression institution pretty in a really abstract and general way, pretty much the same way that a philosopher like John Rawls would use it. I mean by this a really public system of rules, wide scheme of practices that can reproduce themselves over time, that people are aware of, that are publicly acknowledged, and that type of thing. And so when I say that adversarial ethics is a theory of institutional design, it means that it's interesting in the way that we're going to mold these institutions. So now, that can seem like a really trivial claim, but it actually have two really important implications. So the first one, I'm right here on the PowerPoint. So the first one is the fact that it's not really interested into morality in general, but only morality of agent when they are within these institutions or practices that take place within these institutions. And the second, maybe most important implication of this is the fact that it's not adversarial ethics is not interested in all form of rivalry, but only the form of what I could call institutionalized rivalry. So if you take, for instance, a street fight, well, I'm pretty sure that there's a fairly good amount of rivalry between two guys punching each other in the street. But that's not the type of context that should be the object of an adversarial ethics because it doesn't take place into an institution. It's an open fight. It's an open competition. It's not going on along a set of rules that are publicly acknowledged and accepted by agents. So for the same reason, I think, yeah. Yeah, an image is more than worth more than a thousand words. And another type of context that should be excluded is war also, because there's a fairly good amount of rivalry between in cases of war, but that should not be the object of an adversarial ethics, because for the same reason, it's not an institution in itself. War takes place, you know, above this, before the time that we think about institution. So, and I think it's really important to make these precisions because as soon as you really want to clear out what are our normative intuition behind adversarial ethics, you rapidly realize that you first have to establish what type of social institution should be considered as adversarial institution. I mean by this institution that should be the object of an adversarial ethics. And there is a strong tendency among opponents to adversarial ethics to point a lot of contexts where there is rivalry between agents. But I think sometimes that these contexts should not be classified as adversarial institution. And of course, it's much, yeah. So I have two examples here. And so the first one is an example that Mr. Applebaum gives in his book. So I know that you're not exactly claiming that it's an adversarial institution, but you give the example of the l'exécutionneur des hautes œuvres. I don't know exactly how to translate that, but the position of the public executor of Paris. And you say that the way he defines his role is justified by a similar argument that are used in other adversarial contexts to define other roles. There's also the example of health system that you also give, I think, and the example of education system that you don't talk about that example though. So I think that the first condition that an institution must meet to qualify as an adversarial institution is that it should produce social benefits. So it's really easy to point out the failure of adversarial ethics if you use as example institution that we're not even willing to accept the legitimacy. So for this reason, I think we should exclude an institution of public execution. But again, I'm not saying that you're saying that it's an adversarial institution, just to be clear. So that's the first really important condition. The second one is the fact that to consider an institution as an adversarial institution, we have to limit ourselves to institutions that produces their benefit through mechanisms that are essentially based on a dynamic of rivalry. Now, I know this can get pretty complicated pretty quickly, but I still think that it's a really important criteria. So if you take, for example, the healthcare system, well, I think that it should not classify it as an adversarial institution, even if there's a fair amount of rivalry in the healthcare system. And and I'm saying the same thing for the education system also. And so I'm not quite sure how I could really clearly express that criteria, because it rapidly brings down to a matter of level, you know, like how much rivalry do you need to consider that an institution is adversarial or not. But maybe a good test or a good question we could use is ask the question, so could that institution perform that function without rivalry? So, and if we ask that question to the for the healthcare system, for instance, or the educational institution, I think we can answer yes to the question. So those are the two first important conditions. These two conditions are really useful to exclude institutions that are not, that should not be considered as adversarial. But then there's two other characteristics that stem from these two first conditions. So the third one is the fact that because they work essentially on a dynamic of rivalry, adversarial institutions tend to impose a really strong division of moral labor. What do I mean by this? This word, this buzzword, I've come quite often on the discussion yesterday night. But so what I mean by this is the fact that what does a division of moral labor mean? It's the fact that what is good or bad for an institution is different than what is good or bad for agents within these institutions. So one of the most common defense of division of moral labor, or good example, is again in John Rawls' theory of justice, when he claimed that the principle of justice should apply to the basic structure of society, and really doesn't say much about what should be the justice at the individual level, for instance. So, of course, all form of institution impose at some level a division of moral labor. But I think that one of the characteristics of adversarial institution is to impose a much stronger division of moral labor, because the practices of agents within these institutions are really different than what the type of what is expected from the institution in general. What I will say in the next slide will make this clearer, but yeah, for now that's the division of moral work. And another way of expressing this is to say that one of the characteristics of adversarial institution is to establish a role morality that is different from the common morality or day-to-day morality. So this stems also from the division of moral labor. Okay, and so the fourth condition that also stems from the third and the second one is the fact that, so because they impose a really strong division of moral labor, adversarial institution tend to might produce unwanted outcomes, and so you need really strong mechanism of control and monitoring. So the best example for this, I guess, is the market. So that can be described as an adversarial institution from my point of view. And we have all sorts of other institutions to control what is happening in the market and making sure that competition in the market don't lead to unwanted results. So I guess you've pretty much understood the goal of my presentation here. It's to say now, so do a mediatic institution qualify as adversarial institution? That's what I'm going to try to do. So we're not sure about this yet. Okay. So before answering the question, I would just like to say a little bit more about the argument for and against adversarial institution. 5 minutes, okay. I will say things really briefly then. So I think there's basically two arguments for adversarial institution. The first one, there's a weak version or a strong version. So one could say that we should have adversarial institutions because they produce social benefits, or we could say that adversarial institutions are necessary to produce social benefits. That's the first argument. And the second one is that we could say that it's necessary to have adversarial institutions to canalize, I don't know if it's a good expression, to channel various pulsion that will appear in context of rivalry, where two or more agents are trying to compete to satisfy a preference that could not be satisfied by more than one person. And again, I think the good example is Woody Allen and Dov Charney. So they cannot both win their process at the same time. And so we necessarily need institutions to channel the rivalry that will appear between them. So now there's also a fairly good amount of arguments against adversarial institution. So the first one, I think, and the most important, is one developed by Applebaum and also David Lubin. It's the fact that they tend to prescribe practices that are really hard to justify from the point of view of common morality. And so they develop a role morality that give moral permission to agents, but we're not really sure that the argument on which we justify role morality are founded or sounded. I guess a second argument could be that someone could claim, and Markowitz and a political philosopher, Mr. Murphy, claim it also, it's the fact that it's possible to produce adversarial institution benefit without a division of moral labor, so without adversarial practices. We could also claim that it's not necessary to channel rivalry through these institutions. I have no example of this, but I'm pretty sure that somebody out there is doing it right now. And so we could criticize the fact that adversarial institutions tend to produce unwanted consequences. And five, we could criticize the fact that the justification, these two justifications for adversarial institutions, are essentially consequentialist justification. So it's kind of hard to see what it really means, but one of the form it could take, it's the fact that if we rely on consequentialist justification, it could induce some form of a moral crowding out. So it would lead, so if we only justify agent practices in terms of the amount of benefit it produces, well then there's a risk of really having them think too much strategically about all their practices. So I think the first one is the most interesting argument, and I will say why extremely briefly. So I think it's the reason for it is the fact that the adversarial nature of this institution is a necessary condition to producing some specific social benefit. So if we only take courts and tribunal, for example, I had example for all the other institutions, but so we could say that the fact that agents within these institutions follow opportunistic strategies. So in the case of lawyers in courts and tribunal, it's the fact that they're trying to defend their client interests. Well, it brings two really important benefits. So the first one is that there's an epistemic gain, because the fact that they're opposing to each other really helps the court to know as much fact as possible about the case. And the second advantage, we could say that it's some sort of a check and balance mechanism, because it really helps to avoid that too much power be concentrated in the hand of the judge. So we can come back to this in question time if you want. But so basically, I'm saying that these, what I call systemic advantage, are necessary to produce the social good that we want these institutions for in the first place. Okay. So now, what about journalist ethics? 1 minute, okay. Well, I will try to provide an answer to the three questions. So first of all, the first question was, could it be different? Could the relation and between mediatic institution and in mediatic context would not be adversarial? So of course the answer is no. There will always be forms of rivalry between all these actors. But it's really not easy to show that mediatic institutions are adversarial institutions for two reasons, and that this one is the most important one. But anyway, so I'm not sure that they qualify as an institution for whom their main production mechanism is essentially based on a mechanism of rivalry. Okay, and the second argument is the fact that they don't impose such a strong division of moral labor. So if you look at what is good and bad for journalists in mediatic institution, it's pretty much the same thing as what is considered good or bad for the institution at a more systemic level. Second question, so this situation, is it good that there's a rivalry in medias? Well, I think the answer is yes, but only to a limited extent, which is it's good for the same reason that it's good to have competition between economical agents like corporation and economical market. So I don't think it's easy to show that there are some particular benefit that comes from rivalry in the mediatic institution, outside of the general benefits that come from competition between corporation and markets. And last question, what is the best way to make the most out of it? Well, a lot of control and monitoring. So if I can just conclude really briefly, so I think that adversarial institutions are a good thing, but only in really limited cases. And in these cases, we should encourage competition or rivalry. But because of all the moral permission these institutions gives to agents, we should really be careful before giving the status of adversarial institution to an institution. And if we're not sure, it's best to simply not do it. Thank you.
Suggestion and then an invitation. So the suggestion is, though I very much, it's very clear what you've done here, you seem to have chosen to define an adversary institution as already a justified type of its kind. And there might be certain purposes where you'd want to pull those things apart. So you might want to come up with a lower to the ground descriptive account of what an adversary institution is, and that would allow you to ask about it whether or not it's justified. And of course, one could always go one way or the other, but I think it might be a little more helpful for your audience if you've described it without building in its justification. So you didn't moralize the term as much as you did, and then set up your criteria for justification of an adversary institution instead of building it into the definition itself. The invitation, which is very, you're very close to it, is it's very clear as you set this up that all this reflection about adversary institution is kind of a middle-level normative analysis that's going to rest on some deeper commitments that one has in moral philosophy. What your deeper commitments are will affect whether you think these adversary institutions are justified or not. So if you are a certain kind of consequentialist, you're talking very aware of this, if you're a certain kind of consequentialist, then all you need to do to justify an adversary institution is to show that you have maximized the consequences, right, or that the consequences turn out in a certain kind of way. Of course, if you're not that kind of consequentialist, and this is the crowding out idea, but you have to specify what the underlying moral theory would be that would find merely maximizing consequences insufficient. So then you could have a contractualist view. So you might say that, well, it produces good consequences, but these good consequences have to be justified from the point of view or to each person or to most people. So you need an account of justification that it's going to draw upon not your analysis of adversaries, but a deeper analysis of what the underlying moral theory is. So one possible winning observation would be, if, let's say it's Pareto superior. So everybody, this is a mutual advantage point, if everybody is better off than they would have been otherwise, that's a pretty good reason to think that, of course, that's an extremely difficult, yes. So instead you might move to a more kind of a reasonable consent standard, right? So people would agree if they were exercising proper reason in light of the fact that the allocation of burdens and benefits are fair, even though some people will ex post do worse than others, right? But these are ways of being inserting more a more nuanced moral theory into your account of justification.
Okay, so for the first question or suggestion, or so I think you're right. Yeah, I really so I should be clearer about that, because yeah, I really present adversarial ethic as already implying a thesis on the type of morality that should be encompassed in the institution. So maybe I should try to say that I'm trying to see what are adversarial institutions. Maybe I should say that I'm trying to see for which institution should we encourage rivalry. Maybe that would be clearer. Because you're right that but the reason I do it, I guess, even if it's not right, it's because for me, adversarial institutions are the one for which you should encourage rivalry. So I should be clearer about that. You're right. For the second one, which is the biggest problem, I think that as soon as you get out of a consequentialist justification, it's really hard to justify adversarial institutions, because they provide moral permission that are really hard to justify on the basis of common morality. And you do it pretty well in your book. But to a certain extent, I think that this is where the most substantial disagreement lies, actually, between someone that is willing to accept adversarial institutions, the way I define them, and someone that is not willing to accept them. So me, I don't have a problem with institutions that encompass a lot of rivalry, as long as they produce more benefits, necessary benefit that I think could not be produced otherwise. So that's deeply consequentialist as a justification, but I don't think I could be able to justify it out of that if I'm not starting from that base.
Yeah. Just take reasonably just law. I'm not talking about lawyers, but just an obligation to obey the law and an obligation to enforce and punish violations of law. It seems you don't need consequentialist reasons to justify that. In the cases where a mistake is being made, you have contractualist, constructivist reasons for why it is that we should comply with laws, even the ones that aren't perfectly just, and why we should graciously accept punishment when we violate those laws, even when the punishment is really not founded. Right? So that's without adversaries. There are reasons why it is that an institution could justify, on contractualist grounds, outcomes that common morality would see as at least unfortunate.
It's just about a detail. You say that war is out of the scope of adversarial ethics, and with an argument that, if I got it well, you say, because it happens before the institutional level. Something like that. And I'm just wondering, because there are international institutions, and there are a lot of institutions that are dealing with war, or with the consequences of the war. Just, you have international agreements, the Geneva conventions, you have the tribunal, the International Penal Court Tribunal, that is dealing with the consequence of some civil war. So I'm just wondering why you excluded that, because it happens that there are institutions that are dealing with that, and someone may think that adversarial ethics has something to say about it, but the not a fair or just way to manage war, but in order to manage the consequences and just to frame, if it can be framed, in some extent, the context of war. So maybe there are two I'm just wondering about why you say that, why you stated that. There are two ways you can say that war should not be an option for an adversarial ethics, or adversarial ethics doesn't apply to war. I think it's two different, things.
Okay. Your question brings the first comment you were making also about the fact that I define adversarial ethics as already providing a moral criteria, which is the fact that we should encourage competition. So again, maybe if I would be clear on this, I would not have that problem. But now for your question of war. So it's really funny for a start, because it's exactly the type of question that my promoter in Louvain-la-Neuve will ask me, I'm pretty sure, because they always want me to include war into the type of context that should be the object of an adversarial ethics. So I think there's well, there's two easy answers. The first one, I exclude war the same way Charles Taylor decided to only talk about basic structure in the theory of justice. Because this John Rawls, sorry. Where did that come from? Maybe it's the Charles Taylor that was the dictator, not the Charles Taylor that was... Anyway, so, yeah. Or the basketball player, but I didn't know that was a basketball player named Charles Taylor. Anyway, so the same way that he decides to exclude only talk about basic structure and the theory of justice. So it's just to limit the scope of inquiry, because I think that if we include war, then it's going to... we'll introduce a lot of vagueness into the type of moral prescription I want to propose, and it won't be as useful. And I think it's fair to say that what I want to defend is not, I don't know, morality in general. It's just the way that we should organize some specific institution at the domestic level within countries. But anyway, you might not agree with this. The second answer would be the fact that, well, if you accept the first criteria, that you should think about adversary ethics only in the cases of institutions that produce social benefit, it's harder to show that war is an institution that produces social benefit. Even if there are benefit to it in some cases, I think there's a kind difference between that and, for instance, the healthcare system. And the difference is so important that I think it's fair to say that we won't talk of the moral obligation in these two contexts at the same time with the same...
But the institutions that are managing war can be conceived in the adversarial ethics perspective as producing some kind of positive outcomes or just levering down the negative ones.
Like you mean like it's the army, for instance?
Because you seem to consider war as an institution, but maybe for...
No, I don't.
For an adversarial ethics, it's maybe the institution that are managing war. That it's the place of. En français, tu sembles, en fait, tu as répondu en disant la guerre en tant qu'institution, c'est difficile de considérer qu'elle produit des bénéfices.
Oui, okay.
Et ce que je te dirais, c'est que la question n'est pas de savoir si la guerre en tant qu'institution adversative produit des bénéfices, mais c'est plutôt les institutions qui gèrent la guerre, qui produisent ces bénéfices. Donc c'est elles qui peuvent être.
Comme l'armée, like the army, for instance.
Plutôt comme des organisations internationales qui.
Okay.
Chris?
It seems to me that you're overlapping. Maybe you're just your purposes are just different purposes than the ones I'm thinking of. But it seems to me there's two different kinds of institutions that you might usefully distinguish. And I know you don't want to count war as one of them, but let me just put it this way. There are institutions where the conflict is the problem, right? War and courts. Let's say, right, there's a pre-existing conflict, the conflict is there, you've got to do something to civilize it, basically. It's a, you know, you can show people this is a non-zero-sum game. If we play this a little civilized, we can come up better. There are other institutions where the conflict is the mechanism, right? So in markets, competition does fantastic things, right? In football, competition does fantastic things. It gives us on the sidelines something to watch, right? And then the question becomes, in the media, is the, you know, just to take it to the overarching topic here, is the in the case of media, is the conflict something to be solved, or is it something that, you know, is itself producing a positive externality, right? And it might well be, because it's producing, you might say that by having, you know, CNN, CNBC, and Fox News all on the field, you know, the product is some kind of triangulation on the truth or something like that. So anyway, so that's not a very, it's a vague question, but
so,
I'll let you.
So you're kind of suggesting, if I understand you right, a distinction between cases where there is a conflict to solve and cases where we don't want to, there's no need to solve the conflict.
Right, where
the
we promote conflict.
Yeah, that's. I think it's an interesting and relevant distinction. I would have to think about it. Maybe my first thought on it are that it might get really hard to see how you can put decide what goes where. So because, for instance, if you take the pure competition model in market, it's really complicated that, so you want the competition to keep going, but at the same time, there's always resolution of the competition at a lower level. For instance, the competition for selling product at the best price well, there's you solve the competition every day when you buy a product. So, you know, maybe it's hard to say, yeah, maybe it's hard to sort all that out. But, yeah, okay, interesting.
Well, I was a little bit surprised at how quickly you said that in the case of media, unless I misunderstood, the adversarial relationship is not essential to the production of the good. So think about there was a, you know, during the Democratic presidential primary, when at some point the media decided that it wanted Barack Obama to win, there was a funny SNL spoof where they spoofed these journalists asking Obama questions, and the question was, you know, would you like a comfy pillow? You know, Think about what happens when media isn't adversarial enough and throws people that it likes softballs. This is something I'd actually be interested in hearing actual practicing journalists about. You know, you don't want to be, you know, the gotcha journalist is something that's the opposite extreme. You know, I'm going out and whatever, I'm going to get, you know, there's something that can be gotten on that politician, and I'm going to get it, right? Even if I have to sift through their garbage. And on the other hand, there's the do you want a comfy pillow? You know, I like this person so much that I'm just going to, you know, make them appear like God. And so where in the there has to be an attitude somewhere in the middle, which is the right attitude for journalists to have. But it surely has something adversarial-ish about it. In other words, it is, you know, I'm going to be very vigilant about people who wield, especially political power. So I just wonder whether we call it adversarial, the relationship between journalists and, say, politicians, or something else, something that is sort of adversarial-ish.
Merci beaucoup. J'ai trouvé très intéressant ton exposé parce que parfois on parle de la concurrence mais de façon très floue et ton modèle permet de penser. Mais ma question, c'est simplement une question de clarification. Quelle est la différence entre une division du travail moral forte et une division du travail moral faible? Est-ce qu'il y a des caractéristiques? Il y a une différence cruciale?
OK, two good questions. For Daniel's question, so. Okay, the problem, one of the problems I see with the second criteria, besides the fact that it might be under-specified at this point, it's the fact that really rapidly it will shift into an empirical question, because you will always kind of having to ask yourself, well, could that institution produce its benefits without rivalry? And that's more like an empirical inquiry. So it goes out of the realm of moral philosophy quite rapidly. So that it's really a problem with that criteria. So, and I think a good illustration is the example that you have just provided. So I wanted to say a second thing about this. On the fact, I don't remember. It might come back for the division of moral labor. It's. I'm not sure. Yeah, I exactly. You could formulate a clear distinction between a weak division of moral labor and a strong division of moral labor. Maybe one of the way I implicitly do it is, let me shift to another slide. Yes, it's with this table here, because since I present the mechanism of adversarial institution as a mechanism where agents follow opportunistic strategies. And by doing this, they produce systemic advantage. Well, maybe you could say that a strong division of moral labor are cases where systemic advantage are only produces when agents follow opportunistic strategies. So maybe that could be a criteria for a strong division of moral labor. At least in these cases, I've just remembered what I wanted to say for the second one. So at least in these cases, it's sure that what is good or bad for agents is not the same thing as what is good or bad for institution. In these cases, at least you're sure. But, and now for the second thing for Daniel. So with all this, I'm only making a weak claim. You know, I think that when you consider that an institution is an adversarial one, it gives a lot of moral permission to it. And I think that should be encouraged, and it's fine. So I think rivalry or competition should be encouraged in markets. But I'm only saying that when you're not sure, well, then you should not develop public policies that encourage competition so much. I'm trying to provide the cases where you can, with confidence, promote public policies that encourage adversarial practices. Yeah.